Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Hello, everybody. This is Ali Milani on Politics Uncensored at FUBAR Radio. We have a packed show as people go to the polls to vote for local assembly members, local councillors and mayors. We're going to talk about the implications of that today with Murad Qureshi, former London Assembly member. Later on, we'll be joined by Mickey Earhart, campaigner at Disability Rights UK, to talk about some of the PIP changes. And Erica Popplewell, head of campaigns at River Action, talks to us about the rivers. And we've got lots to talk about this week, from Scottish government divided to Khan's record being divided to Rwanda. The flights have finally taken off, albeit a voluntary scheme to begin with. But before we get to any of that, the principal thing on everybody's mind: did you hear the thunder last night? Which is what we've been talking about in the studio. It felt like the Russian missiles had finally landed in the UK, but I can comfortably say apparently that was not the case. And we are all safe for now. Although it may not be missiles that get us in the end, it might be climate change. And that's what I think the thunder was warning us about. Joining me now, we're going to talk about this week's politics, news and issues that have been raised around the country is Murad Qureshi, returning to the show, former London Assembly member. Murad, how are you keeping?
I'm not too bad, Ali. I'm your voice from the Edgware Road, W9.
Loving it. Did you hear the thunder from W9 last night, or did you sleep through it?
It woke me up, certainly, that's for sure. And it got me out of bed sooner than I normally do to get to the gym.
Oh, you went to the gym. Brave man. Brave man. I just hid under my blankets thinking that the rockets were headed my way, but it turned out to be okay. Murad, as you know, people are headed to the polls today, specifically as people elect local councillors, local mayors and assembly members to begin with. I would love it, you know, one of the things, the feedbacks I got on our show previously was people not want to know specifically what the assembly member does and London Assembly member does. As a former member of the London Assembly, can you tell our listeners what the London Assembly is and what its members do?
Well, essentially, we're your eyes and ears of Londoners to keep an eye on the mayor. That's what scrutiny of the mayor involves. But it's not just scrutiny of the mayor. There's other entities like the Metropolitan Police, the Fire Service, Transport for London, and even other entities like Thames Water, the water utilities. And I like to think I made a contribution on all those fronts. But predominantly, it's keeping an eye on the mayor between financial years, passing or not his financial budgets, and scrutinising and looking into his policies and that he wants to instigate to deliver their aims.
And people have just under 5 hours left to go out to the poll. So if you're listening live, please do go out and make sure that you vote. Take ID with you. This is the first election where we're going to need photo ID. I was just at the polling station before we got on air and I was asked for my ID before I voted. So make sure that you take it. Murad, we're going to talk about this week's big stories, and we will begin with London. And that's looking ahead at the mayoral results. YouGov's latest poll ahead of the London mayoral election on Thursday, which is today, shows Labour incumbent Sadiq Khan with a 22-point lead over Tory challenger Susan Hall. Fieldwork was conducted among 1,100 adults in London between the 24th and the 30th of April, with the vast majority of respondents gathered between the 24th and the 27th. Currently, 47% say they're going to vote for Sadiq, compared to 25% with Susan Hall. This is what I'm interested in, to get your views on. Murad, despite being comfortably in the lead in terms of the election, Sadiq does have a challenge with his favourability ratings, 46% having unfavourable views of the mayor versus 38% which have a favourable one. And Londoners are also divided on his record to date, with 41% saying he has done a good job and 45% saying he has done a bad job. It's a little bit weird. People are quite happy to re-elect him. I'm not hearing these numbers on the streets myself, but Londoners are divided on Sadiq himself. Is this just a reflection of where our politics is and generally people are divided?
Well, Ali, I'll start with my position. I personally discount all polls 2 weeks before the actual poll today. Mm-hmm. I don't think they really held a debate at all. And if there was one lesson to learn from French politics, is actually not having polls for the last 2 weeks of the campaign. But nonetheless, it has been dominated by that. I think the most significant thing I've seen in the last 48 hours is for the first time ever we've had the Evening Standard, opinion former in London, coming out in favour of a Labour mayor. I can remember in 2000 when it was Stephen Norris, 2004 Stephen Norris, 2008 Boris Johnson, 2012 Boris Johnson, 2016 Zach Goldsmith. That is, I think, a huge and major change. I've seen evidence since with postal vote voters, as well as today on the doorstep, that Lib Dem and Greens are voting for Sadiq as mayor. But I don't think it will be as dramatic a difference as the polls are suggesting. I've always known that the polls to be tighter in London, particularly with the changes in the way you vote and first past the post. But nonetheless, I can't see anything else but a Sadiq victory during the weekend. But that's not to be complacent. I haven't. That's why I've been doing door knocking. I'll probably do some door knocking later on. And I don't know the picture in outer London, of course, as well.
Yeah,
and you probably know better than I do.
Yeah, and we've. It's funny. My wife and I were walking towards the polling station today, and she asked me, you know, I think in jest, but who even is the Tory candidate? I've not seen anything of them. And obviously, I think that was in jest. But there is a question to be asked as to whether the Conservatives are giving up on London increasingly. And I ask this because their last two candidates have been objectively awful. So both Sean and Susan Hall have been terrible candidates, not heavyweights in any way, shape or form. Do they not care about London? Have they given up on London? Do they just not think they're going to win? And so, you know, the big hitters aren't contesting it. What's going on?
Well, Ali, I totally agree with you there. I think they've given lightweight into to become their mayoral candidates. The only brave thing about it is electing assembly members. I think if we did have good, decent assembly members who have a pan-London perspective on issues, I think sometimes very often the councillors, council leaders and our parliamentarians don't often have that when they go for that. The only person who did have that was, interestingly enough, the first mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. But whilst the Tories have done well to put assembly members up, they've clearly put up the wrong ones, and ones not up to it. I think it's clearly a reflection that parliamentarians in the Tory party didn't want to take the chalice. I was expecting others to throw their hats in from the House of Commons, Kit Malthouse, James Cleverly, who had previously been assembly members. They've got some idea of the major issues of London. I disagree with him on many things. He, and particularly on the Met, does have an interest in police.
So why do you think some of these more heavy hitters haven't stood? Is it that they don't think they can win, or do they not want the job, or do the Tory party have just fobbed off London? What's going on? Like, what do you think the reason?
I think there is that. I think the focus since 2019 has been on the, dare I say, the red seats and keeping them and what have you. Totally. And with the Brexit message, they know it wasn't going down very well at all in London, which hadn't helped. I think it's an important part of running for mayor is personal ambitiousness. James Cleverly, for example, if he wasn't Home Secretary now and previously Foreign Secretary, I'm sure he would have thrown his hat in for this. When we shared our time, it was quite clear that he was eyeing the position as a step towards higher office.
Yeah.
But in some ways, he doesn't need to do that now that he's Home Secretary and almost certainly a contender for the party leadership after the next general election.
Okay, well, let's stay in London as we talk about a really tragic case of knife crime that we've all seen, I think, in Hainault. Policing Minister has blamed London's soaring rate of knife crime on a reduction in the Metropolitan Police's use of stop and search powers. Chris Philip claimed that there was a direct link and accused Sadiq Khan, the Labour Mayor of London, who is also the capital's police and crime commissioner, of failing to hold the force to account over its decline in the use of stop and search. Knife crime increased by 20% in the capital last year compared with 2022, while increasing by only 7% for the entirety of England and Wales. The capital accounted for 29% of all 49,489 knife crime-related offences in England and Wales. It seems like Tories, whenever they hear knife crime, they just think stop and search. What's your response to the policing minister blaming knife crime rates going up to a reduction in the Met Police's use of stop and search powers?
I'm not convinced of the arguments. I'll say that there and then. I think you have to be much more focused and use intelligence in your approach. What's telling, I think, is that the Hainaut stabbing, death, or killing, let's call it that, was with a full grown white male and a small black boy. And I dare say, if the colours were different, there may be much bigger news story. Mm-hmm.
Can I just intervene? The Sun's front page today, calling that boy Sword Lad, it's fucking disgusting.
Yeah.
And I mean, look, never pick up the Sun, never give an interview with the Sun anyway. But genuinely, to whoever, whichever editor came up with that, whichever writer came up with that, shame on you. That's disgusting. Yeah. That a young boy has lost his life as a result of knife crime, and they've put it in a little section on the right hand side and referred to him as Sword Lad. Sorry to interrupt, Murat.
No, Ali, I share your sentiments. I just didn't know how far I could go on this radio show with you on that.
Well, you've seen how far I've gone now, so just follow me.
The Hainaut is a horrific attack, and I think the focus needs to be on the particular circumstances there. Like I said, I dare say if the victim was different, then I it would have been.
Yeah, let's talk about Stop and Search as well, because look, I've been a big. Contributor to this point of discussion, largely because it took up so much of, it was such an important factor in my upbringing, in your neck of the woods. We have plenty of research now, I think 15 years of worth of research, that shows Stop and Search doesn't work. It increasingly alienates minority communities with the police. It damages relationships within the communities, between communities and police, which is where good policing happens. And critically, the link between Stop and Search and prosecutions for the kind of crimes that we're talking about is almost non-existent. So why do these guys keep talking about this nonsense when it's been proven not to work?
Well, Ali, it's quite clear they've got an agenda, and they're not reading the same kind of reports that me and you have seen and been involved in, and scrutinies as well at council and London Assembly level. The fact of the matter is, in my time on the W9, actually most of the Stop and Search was aimed at the Irish lads.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm talking 70s and 80s and Caribbean lads as well. And I got kind of caught up in it being an Asian lad hanging around with my
well, the best interventions have clearly been, have come from intelligence from within the communities.
Yeah.
And communities, colleges, sixth forms, schools, but also community organizations and community leaders engaging with the police. You're not going to do that when they perceive the Metropolitan Police to be institutionally racist and targeting black and brown boys primarily in Stop and Searches. So it's just undercutting the police.
Yeah. And also, I don't disagree there. And also, let's not, certainly in my time, there was plenty of youth clubs. Playing fields, after school activities at schools. In my case, we had the Inner London Education Authority providing all those things.
Yeah.
I took it for granted, assuming they'll be there for life. And we've actually not only lost them, we're actively behind in replacing them.
And like you're saying, and that's where the research suggests that an increase in crime comes from. It's the reduction and the elimination of these youth clubs, these things that young people who often live in deprived areas can do and go to. I mean, I went to a youth club in Ladbroke Grove, which you'll know was now closed. Right, that's what we did after school.
Yeah, and I went to the one on Porchester Road called Portobello, although it wasn't on Portobello Road. It kept me out of trouble. And during most weekends, were taken up playing football for the Stoke Boys Club on the Harrow Road. Those kind of things we took for granted. Unfortunately, they're not there anymore. And also the support systems. I mean, many dads and what have you ran those football clubs, took us out on a Saturday or Sunday mornings. Gave us a time and energy that we haven't had since, or I've not seen evidence of. But that side of it shouldn't be forgotten. And I think the Met also needs to get on top of things. I think since the Casey report, it seems to have died a death. It's more than a year old now. And the focus seems to have been moved away. I mean, this is a report that accuses them of not just institutional racism, but misogyny, homophobia, and what have you. There's a lot not quite right, actually, in the Met Police, and that needs to be sorted as soon as possible, as soon as we get a new mayor in with a new term. And I think that's the main issue in London. And let's hope we can get on to that after this weekend.
Yeah, we're going to move on from London and talk about a more nationwide story, and that is surrounding Rwanda. A first failed asylum seeker has gone to Rwanda under a voluntary removals program, it is understood. Under the scheme announced last month, migrants whose claims are rejected are offered up to £3,000 to move to the East African country. It is separate to the forced return scheme the government announced 2 years ago. The scheme, which has been beset by delays, is due to begin in mid-July. The Sun, which first reported the story, said the unnamed man was flown out of the UK on Monday on a commercial flight. Officials would not be drawn in on the details of that flight, other than to say the asylum seeker had exhausted all rights to be in the UK. The Rwanda government confirmed that a failed asylum seeker arrived on Tuesday on a flight from London. Labour said the move showed ministers were desperate to get a flight off to Rwanda before Thursday's local elections in England. This has been a flagship policy for Rishi Sunak. It seems like it's, you know, they've gotten one flight and one person off, but it's a voluntary scheme. Do you think that this is going to wash with people? Is it going to have any effect on their polling numbers?
I'm not sure it will. And the only other thing I would like to emphasise is the huge expense involved. It's almost like David Cameron going on a private jet to Central Asia. It's those kind of astronomical figures. Can you imagine what else we could have done with that kind of money?
If we didn't. In the context of us telling that, of us being told that constantly that there's no money for the NHS, there's no money for welfare systems, all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. When it's a political priority for a forthcoming general election, there's a money tree available and funds are made available. I mean, that kind of money could be spent quite easily on those youth centres and what have you that we mentioned earlier in a previous item.
Yeah.
I personally don't think it's the problem is as big as they're making out. I've not heard it on in doorsteps of London, nor in pubs or night venues that I go to at all. It's not a talking point. It may be in other parts of the country, but it's skewed to particular political priorities for the general election. And it shows that the Tory government have been in power for too long and have completely lost sight of things which involves huge expenses like this.
Yeah,
I mean it's and also of course let's not forget some of the Tory ministers need to improve their geography. I mean there was a major gap last week.
Did you see that? Can you tell people what we're talking about? Because that was legitimately the gaffe of the year.
Yeah.
So
I know Rishi Sunak was very keen for all of us to do maths up to 18, which I don't knock. It's not a bad idea. I did A-level maths, for example. But the when his own MPs and PPCs can't get their geography of Africa correct, I think maybe geography O-level or a bit of geography of Africa is what's in order.
Yeah. If anyone doesn't know what we're talking about, just search Rwanda Question Time on Twitter or any other program, and you will see a Tory MP and I think minister confusing Rwanda with, was it Uganda? I don't remember what other African country.
The Congo.
So he was being asked a question about an asylum seeker, a refugee who'd come from Congo, which has very difficult relationships with Rwanda, and whether they would be sent back to Rwanda. And he had to ask the question as to whether the Congo is its own country or it's part of Rwanda. You could not make it up.
it just does make me wonder about the caliber of people that you need to become a PPC in the Tory party now.
Murad, if I might ask, just an extension of this topic, there was a lot of alarm that the Home Office tweeted this video. I don't know if you've seen, but the Home Office tweeted a video essentially saying the first forced removals, which was the actual policy that Rishi Sunak and the Tories have announced, the first arrests have been made, and that was done yesterday. And there was a large amount of concern that the video looked alarmingly like a campaign video. Now, whether you've seen the video or not, I don't know, but are you alarmed at the increasing sort of politicization of the Home Office when it's supposed to be a politically neutral sort of civil service body?
Indeed. I mean, look, I haven't seen the video, but the politicization of a critical department like the Home Office over the last two or three Home Secretaries, I think it certainly happened during Priti Patel's time and was further exacerbated by Suellen Braverman, certainly. Things are continuing, unfortunately, under James Cleverly. I don't think that bodes very well. Whoever takes over the Home Office after the next general election has got a real job in getting back its focus and concentrating on things that matter on a day-to-day level rather than as part of a political campaign to keep the present government in power.
Okay, Murad, I'm going to let you go. Get on that doorstep and door knock before polls close, I think, in about 4.5 hours. That was Murad Qureshi, former London Assembly member, joining us for This Week Unwrapped. Always a pleasure to have you, Murad. We're going to move on today, and we're going to talk about the government's major changes to disability benefits system. And we're going to be joined by campaigner at Disability Rights UK, Mickey Earhart, who's going to be joining us after these messages.
FUBAR Radio presents
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Joining me now is Millie Gooch, author and founder of Sober Girl Sobriety Society. I need to know what is so bad about dating sober.
I think it's just terrifying when it's something that you're not used to, because when I was drinking and dating, you know, like, you use it to calm your nerves, you use it for confidence, you rely on it. And I think that's the one thing I realised when I stopped drinking, is how much I really relied on alcohol. I was always kind of saying, you know, like, oh, I'm not dependent on it, but for my confidence I was really. But I also think there's so many benefits to it. Like, I used to go on so many dates when I was drinking, I'd be like, they are the one, and then I'd meet them like a few weeks later sober, and I'd be like, we've got nothing in common. What was going through my mind? I'd be like, oh, it was because I was drunk.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Harpreet, how are you, my love?
I'm great, thank you. How are you? It looks fun in there.
I want to talk about this because obviously you met your partner on The Apprentice. When did you start to get that feeling, I'm into him, and this is more than just a banter or a friendship? Because it's a close environment being on a show like that, isn't it?
I really wish I could sit here and give loads of juicy gossip. Actually, we used to secretly meet in the laundry room on the show, but we didn't. And when I actually last spoke with yourselves, I think it was right after I'd won, we weren't even flirting, never mind dating. First time that I thought I actually fancied him was when I watched him on TV and I watched episode one. Hang on. You know, he's actually really good looking.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polansky. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
So you're hoping for 4 MPs in the general. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take out, I don't have £1,000, will you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get 4 MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling. So for me to place a bet there would be pretty,
you know,
pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke, and I said I would, because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral standing.
We should also talk about cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back to FUBAR Radio. This is Politics Uncensored. I'm your host, Ali Milani, and we're talking about the major news stories of the week. And we've just had Murad Qureshi on, and we've talked about Stop and Search, as well as the country going to the polls, electing local mayors, local councillors, and local assembly members. But we're not going to focus locally now. We're going to focus on a more nationwide story, and that is the government is considering major changes to the disability benefits system. In plans announced on Monday, it said reforms to personal independent payments, known as PIP, could include stopping regular cash payments and instead offering claimants one-off grants for things such as home adaptations. It comes as Prime Minister Rishi Sunak vowed to end Britain's sick note culture, saying that the number of economically inactive young people was a tragedy. Well, joining me now is Mickey Earhart, a campaigner at Disability Rights UK. Mickey, thank you so much for joining us. Give us your initial reactions to Rishi Sunak's announcement and these policy changes.
Hi, Alec. Thank you so much for having me on. I mean, to be honest, like, of course, I was angry, right? And worried about my friends, loved ones, and colleagues who are all likely to be swept up in these sort of changes if they were to go through. But in all honesty, can I say I was surprised? Not at all. This is, by my count, probably the third major sort of attack on our social security system since the budget in November. I remember writing at the time, I wrote an article about sort of how the changes weren't going to help, right? That was back in the budget. That was Jeremy Hunt talking about how we all needed to to work more, and no one would be able to have a life on benefits. Not that anyone does that anyway, but I wrote at the time how the government knows that this causes anguish, distress, and ultimately puts people in really difficult situations. And we're here again. Mm-hmm. But since then, government has proposed, you know, ending support to those with severe mobility problems, which would be around £400 lost a month, increasing work conditionality, more possible sanctions if you don't hit certain criteria. We've had consultations and proposals around removing entitlements to people who have substantial risk to their physical and mental health if they're found fit for work. Then there's the proposal to scrap the work capability assessment, which would have quite a lot of major consequences. And then recently as well, the idea of removing a GP's responsibility for issuing fit note.
Yeah, can we talk about that, the GP issue? Because I think proposal from the government is currently you're deemed whether you're fit to work or not by your general practitioner, which is your doctor that you go and see and who knows your medical history and who is engaged with you. I mean, we already have difficulty seeing our GPs anyway, but that's the person who has the responsibility to declare you fit to work. What's the government proposing now, to outsource that to someone else?
So they have proposed that this would go to a sort of unnamed healthcare professional. In the same way that we already have sort of our assessment process for things like PIP outsourced to large companies. So perhaps be something similar. Obviously, there's no evidence, right, to back up the claims that sick notes are being given out like sweets by gullible MPs. But we know that in reality, the rise in mental health problems is all too real, right? 1.9 million people waiting on waiting lists at the moment for NHS services. I really don't see how any of these sort of proposals will make any of that better.
And the difference of that, of course, might mean that if it's gone to a company, they may have targets set to get people into work, whereas your doctor has a HIPAA responsibility to your healthcare and making sure that they do no harm. So ultimately, what we're talking about here is people's lives, right? The risk to people's lives.
Absolutely, right? And I think it's really important to sort of talk about our benefit system, not as if it's something that people are given out easily, right? People are already under high levels of surveillance, subject to lots of assessments, right? Some people are assessed yearly, even more frequently, right? So the idea that it's really easy to access the benefit system, to get what is a very small amount of money in the grand scheme of things, right? To tackle ultimately systemic issues, right? Around how we've built our world to be inaccessible to disabled people is sort of, frankly, pretty insulting. Mm. And I think, as you mentioned, right, like, those sort of structural issues with how assessments are done have been written about countlessly. I know a big issue Isabella McCrae has written about sort of the problems that assessors themselves have working under this sort of system, right? The time pressures, like you say, that they work under, the sort of effect on their own health, that the work that they do, giving sort of even more responsibility into these sort of outsourced workplaces where there is time pressure, where you are expected to work in these pretty difficult conditions. I don't really see how that can be sort of aligned with the idea of assessing someone's health and how to support someone, which is sort of...
I wonder, look, there's been a lot of discussion and quite a lot of controversy around Rishi Sunak and this sick not culture. I wonder what your response is, given that most people that we've heard and spoken to have been pretty outraged by this comment, considering we've got millions of people on an NHS waiting list who are waiting to see doctors and healthcare professionals, a mental health crisis in the country, and a national healthcare service which is seriously underfunded and under-resourced, and the government and the prime minister seems to be blaming the individuals rather than the systems he's responsible for.
It's incredibly frustrating, right? Just a week ago, the United Nations investigators, right, issued a report which found at least 600 deaths of disabled people were linked to the DWP's policies. Writers like John Pring, Disability News Service, have written about the deaths of benefit claimants for years, right? And there are secret reviews that the DWP do into the deaths of benefit claimants. Those have doubled over the past 3 years. So this rhetoric has an end point, right? It's dangerous, right? You don't learn as an individual you're not born with prejudice against disabled people, but you learn it through, right, everything that you see in the media from the government every day. And so to hear the Prime Minister, to hear Mel Stride, the Work and Pensions Secretary, discuss our experiences as disabled people with such clear disdain, it's belittling, and it also will have consequences, right? It will lead to more people either being subject to surveillance, not just by state, but also by colleagues or, you know, people in their local community who are wondering, you know, are you a benefit cheat or any of that sort of stuff. I've had loads of people talk to me.
And
about
we've
that.
And look, and then, I want to ask, because you mentioned the United Nations there, and I think since 2010, we've gotten quite a consistent, and obviously the austerity that came after, we've gotten a consistent number of reports and messaging from the United Nations concerning the deaths of disabled people in the UK being linked to the policy of the government and the DWP. I think you mentioned 600,000 earlier. A few years ago, we had the United Nations Special Rapporteur who said that there might be legal challenges to the government and their responsibility under human rights to disabled people who've lost their lives as a result of that. Is that the scale of what we're talking about now, where the government's policies are really linked to deaths and there could be liabilities? I mean, we won't talk about the legalities because neither of us are particularly qualified in that area, but that's the scale of things that we're talking about. People, hundreds of thousands of people losing their lives directly linked to DWP policy.
So the UN's report was at least 600 people, right? So not in the hundreds of thousands that they could point to, mm-hmm. but we know that austerity has had long-term consequences, right, on the health of the nation. And I think that's really important to think about. And you can't remove sort of the conversation around benefits from the wider project of austerity, right? If you're cutting off support in terms of NHS or social care or even things like local public transport provision, that's going to have health impacts. It's going to make people more unwell, and it's going to, in the long run, perhaps sort of reduce how long we live in certain cases. Yeah. And I think there isn't momentum on either side of the house right now to do something about the structural changes that are required for disabled people to have even just the life of a non-disabled person right now, not even thinking about making a world that is better for everyone.
I just want to be clear, sorry, because I made a mistake earlier. You were talking about 600 people. I was referring to a different report which referenced 100,000 people may have been impacted by the policy. So I just want to make that clear. Lastly, I want to ask you, if you had the ear of a future government sat in this room, for example, listening to you, what do they need to do to start to move the conversation on?
Well, I think the first thing to do, right, is understand that improving our public services, raising benefit levels, even if it leads to high taxes, is more popular than ever, right? It's gone up 10% in the last 10 years. It's around about 38% of people are like very strongly agree with that statement. So it's not something that's a fringe belief or something that would cause you political strife, let's say it that way, right? Like, ignore the actual moral and sort of rights-based reasons to do anything like this. But if I had the ear of someone, I'd say that the first thing that they need to do is grind a new system in the social model of disability, right? Social model of disability has been developed over the last 40 years by disabled people, activists, campaigners. And what it holds at its center is the idea that the discrimination, exclusion, and oppression that we face as disabled people has nothing to do with us or our impairments. It is because we've built a world that is hostile to us, right? We are disabled by the barriers that operate in society, of which one of them is this hostile rhetoric around benefits, right? So the first thing that I'd want to like have done is ground any new system in the social model built on respect and dignity and support that focuses less on punitive sanctions, caps, conditionality, wait times, and focuses on giving people like a guaranteed decent income, like giving people the support we need to have that long-term view that like the welfare system isn't something that can just be prodded out and cut all the time and made a scapegoat, that the benefit system is a piece of social infrastructure that makes everyone's lives better, right? It being there is really important, and we just talk about it in this way as if it is just money thrown about easily when it's just vital.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. That was Mickey Edhart, campaigner at Disability Rights UK, talking to us about Rishi Sunak's vow to end Britain's sick note culture and the changes to PIP. Mickey, thank you so much for joining us. I have to say, it takes quite a lot of audacity for the Prime Minister to talk about sick not culture when the NHS is on its knees around the country and when all we're hearing from doctors and nurses is the millions and millions of people on waiting lists. The fact that we are now in a stage where the NHS is missing diagnoses because of the lack of investment, the high waiting times, and the post-COVID undoubtedly impacts that we've had. And the Prime Minister, rather than focusing on these issues, has decided to attack disabled people and migrants with the Rwanda scheme. So it gives you a good sense as to the desperation of the Conservative government and this Prime Minister to attack sick, not culture, having not addressed the underlying causes. But that is just one man's opinion. We're going to move on next to talk about the demand from a new alliance that's been forced, Seven Water-Based Sports, forming an alliance to talk about tackling water pollution. This comes a month after the boat race, the Oxford men's boat race, was marred after the crew got sick with E. coli amid high levels of sewage in the Thames. I'm going to be joined by the head of campaigns at River Action after this.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
FUBAR Radio presents
The Dating Show. So we have got the incredible Sunita.
How does Sunita whittle down the people she wants to talk to the people she doesn't? What's your criteria?
Well, you've got to be an adult.
okay.
That's always a good start.
Always a good start. But when I'm an adult, not just like 18, you've got to be like not young enough to be my child. you have to ideally be London-based, because I am. Yeah. Although I don't mind if you've got a country pad, that would be nice.
So at the minute we're going with age and location are important.
Age and location are good.
Every Friday from 6 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. This is Ali Milani at Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio. Seven water-based sports have formed an alliance to demand the government go further and faster in tackling water pollution. It comes less than a month after the boat race was marred by Oxford men's crew getting sick with E. coli amid high levels of sewage in the Thames. Now, this story is in the context of over the last year and a half, lots of conversations around pollution of water more generally, including drinking water, but we're going to focus specifically on this issue and the alliance that's been formed to demand that the government move quicker and further on tackling water pollution. Joining us now, we have Erica Popplewell, head of the campaigns at River Action. Erica, thank you so much for joining us. Do you want to give listeners a little bit of an overview as to where this campaign came from?
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be part of the show. So, as you have said, everyone is becoming more and more aware of river pollution as an issue. And if you're an organisation and you represent a sport which is relies on the river to provide your venue, then your levels of worry have been increasing. And so we've seen organisations coming together, making contact, talking to River Action. That's where I'm from. We're a campaigning organisation for rescuing Britain rivers, and joining together to form a united voice, which is more powerful to bring about change.
Mm-hmm. And so this is specifically, I mean, the story's come up about after the Oxford men's crew got sick with E. coli. Can you tell us what that story was about and what happened?
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. So in the month preceding the boat race, my colleague Chloe, who lives in London, went down every day to the River Thames with an E. coli testing kit. That's a clever blue tube that's made by a company called Fluidian. And that incubates the water that you collect from the Thames. And then some hours later, you can see what's grown. So we did that. And we found that, unfortunately, E. coli levels were higher than the recommended safe levels for bathing every single day that we tested before the boat race. And at some days, it was up to 10 times higher than it was supposed to be. So we broke that story, and we knew it was going to be a big story, but we didn't know. And I guess actually we were sad that it became such a huge story, because, as you said, some of the Oxford rowers were indeed ill with what they suspected was E. coli, and that affects the sport, and sport should be a fair competition between two players, and if one of them's not well, then it's not the same competition, is it?
And how come the boat race was allowed to take place given the risk that might have existed for the participants?
I'm not an organiser of the boat race, so it's mm-hmm. not for me to say that, but I would say that there are actions that can be taken, that we have endorsed like a guidelines for rowers as part of a partnership we have with British Rowing that apply to other water-based sports around ways you can reduce the risk, and we would advocate that everyone does that. It's like washing down your blades, covering any cuts and open sores that you might have. So there are steps that you can take to reduce it, but I'm not an organiser of the boat race.
So, okay, let's talk about the actual high levels of sewage in the Thames. Is this a new phenomenon, or has it always been this case? Because as far as I remember, as long as I was a kid and going anywhere near the Thames, it's always looked disgusting to me. Is this a new phenomenon? What's changed basically to bring about this story?
I think there's always been an issue because there are certain circumstances when water companies up and down the country are allowed to spill sewage directly into watercourses. That happens when there is extremes of weathers and when their systems are overflowing and they can't cope. So the only way to keep the rest of the system working is to overflow. So I think there have been three changes, actually. One, there is more extreme weather as a result of climate change and the climate emergency which we're in. Secondly, there has been a chronic lack of investment in infrastructure by water companies over the last 30 years since they were privatized. So population is growing, extreme weather events are happening more, but the systems isn't being maintained and upgraded that would be necessary to reduce the need for these spills to happen. And thirdly, monitoring has increased. So we know we have a better idea of the picture. Through E. coli testing by ourselves and testing by the water companies, which is now in some instances like a mandatory practice that they have to do and publish those results. So there is more journalistic and campaigning scrutiny.
So these dangerous waters, we've already seen people get sick with the boat race that we've spoken about. Is there any risk to the general public as well? Because the Thames runs quite long. People, you know, there's multiple boats that get on that Thames. Does that pose any risk to the general public?
I think anybody using the River Thames has a risk of contracting E. coli or other diseases because it's, as we've seen from the results, it's in the water and it's above what's declared safe limits by the Environment Agency, I believe. Mm-hmm. So yes, if you're going to swim in the stretches further up from central London, then you know it's possible to swim in the Thames. If you're kayaking, paddleboarding, all those instances, there's a risk. And we've even heard of people whose dogs have become very poorly when they've gone and had a paddle and you throw in a tennis ball in and in they go. And next thing you know, there's a very poorly dog at the vet. So it affects animals as well.
Mm-hmm. Look, we've all been to different cities around the world, really. But let's focus on Europe. Not every city's main river that runs through the city looks like ours. Why is ours so gross?
Is it
avoidable, I guess, is the question I'm really asking.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree. Partly it's a matter of geography. The River Thames is a large river. The City of London is at the end of it. It's a tidal river during the section in London, so that plays an effect. But it's also the dirtiest river in Europe, as far as I understand. And that is because of what I just set out, that there's been a poor maintenance and this is the effect. So it's probably worth talking about the River Seine in Paris at this point. It's also a major city, similar size to London, where there's many millions of people and a large river. With these Olympics happening this summer in Paris, the Olympic organisers have organised that the triathlon event and the marathon open water swimming will take place on the River Seine in the middle of the city. To do that, they put a huge amount of investment, billions of pounds, into major infrastructure projects to upgrade the river and to make that possible. And to show that they are serious about it, the Paris mayor and the president of France will be swimming in a sort of showpiece event at the end of next month, from our understanding. So it can be done. It takes investment, and that needs to be...
And presumably, that's going to be a huge win for the Olympics, but it will follow through for the citizens of Paris, who will have cleaner waters in the city. I reckon
Olympic year, then Paris citizens and holidaymakers will be able to swim in the River Seine in Paris. Yeah.
If we had people, any sort of swimming race or swimming in the River Thames, they'd probably have to swim straight to Barts Hospital to get treated.
Thomas is also right on the river.
Mm-hmm. So the demand has been that the government go further and faster in tackling this water pollution. What can the government do?
The government has several actions that would make a big difference. At the moment, we have a system of private companies running water, which is a local geographical monopoly. You don't have a choice when you move to an area of who supplies your water, but it is a private company that's doing that. That system, to my mind, only works if there is strong regulation. At the moment, the regulators, like the Environment Agency, have been defunded, so their funding has been reduced by something like 70 over the last decade. So they're not able to do the job that they should do.
I'm interested in this regulation and this privatization, given that water is a fundamental part of human life. How are they basically, these water companies, allowed to do pretty much whatever they want?
Well, they were privatised over 30 years ago, and I think we have seen a decline in investment. There hasn't been a reservoir built in the UK during the time of private water companies. I asked the same question, and I don't have the answers. There must be conversations going on that I am not party to and you're not party to around that. Mm-hmm. There's an ongoing cycle of price review where the water companies talk to Ofwat, which is the other regulator I think has action to take, and they decide what we're allowed to charge consumers. I do think there's a point to say that we pay very comparatively little for our water. We pay less a day for our water for the average UK household than you'd pay for coffee on the high street. So water is quite cheap. But I would also say, if you look at the figures, a huge amount of money has been taken out in shareholder dividends over this period. I also asked why. I'm afraid on that one, I don't have the answers. You should get someone else in your show.
No. Look, I'm interested. Look, it's interesting because we're not talking about luxury items or even, you know, additions to life. Water is a human right.
I would call it a non-discretionary purchase. You don't have a choice but to purchase water because you cannot live without it.
So. Yeah, I mean, so there's two ways of looking at what you just said. We relatively pay little compared to a price of coffee. That's only true if we're getting clean water, first of all. If the water's full of sewage, then we have different questions that we want to ask in terms of health. The cost doesn't matter. But it's also the question of, should we pay anything for water? It's not the discussion me and you are having now, but certainly if we're paying for water and there's a monopoly and it's been privatized, the basic expectation is that government regulates these private companies and make sure, A, we're getting good value for money, B, probably that there shouldn't be a monopoly, and C, that the water is safe. And I don't think any of these three things are happening, are they?
I think I would say that I don't question the water coming out my tap is safe. It's the wider environment and the rivers that is where the risk is. So,
I mean, I guess that's quite important. We don't want to alarm people that the water that they're drinking isn't safe.
Exactly. Yeah. I always drink water straight out the tap.
Yeah.
I have no concerns on that. But it's the wider environmental. And I think of rivers as an entity, as a bit of a silent stakeholder in this whole conversation that's going on. We haven't mentioned the elephant in the room, maybe we'll get there, that Thames Water itself is in dire financial straits. Mm-hmm. Thames Water has control of most of the River Thames. As a company, it is teetering on the edge of bankruptcy or something similar. And we're now at a point where all the different people with an interest in the company are shouting in the media about what they need to happen so that their interests are preserved. River Action is trying to wave the flag for the river itself and the environmental standards and the ecosystem that it supports, all the species of invertebrates, fish, plants that live in the river, because they also need to be considered when we look at how we either restructure, renationalize, or something similar with Europe's largest water company.
Yeah, I guess we'll get to Thames Water last, but that's something we haven't spoken about. We've spoken a lot about the health to humans, but there are a lot of other species and animals that live in the River Thames that will likely also be facing the consequences of this pollution. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and absolutely. And the sad fact is, there are indeed species that used to live in the River Thames that we now hardly see in the river at all, such as Atlantic salmon, where the fish stocks have been absolutely decimated by the sewage pollution. Mm-hmm. And you get to a situation where the E. coli levels are high, or there's also agricultural pollution, which can cause high levels of phosphates and nitrates, which causes eutrophication. You might remember it from your GCSE biology. I've been delving back into that knowledge in this role. There's too much nutrients in the river, which might sound like a good thing, but it means that you get a bloom or huge growth of algae. The river goes very, very green, but that actually suffocates all the other species that live in the river that all connect to each other, of course, in that ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, let's come on to Thames Water. You said they're teetering on the brink. What's the situation with Thames Water, and what's the impact of the dangers of them going under to ordinary citizens in London?
I think the sad fact is we just don't know at the moment. We know that they have a huge repayment schedule of loans that they are at risk of defaulting on, so not being able to pay money that they owe to other people, which I think means that they will be effectively going bust. They are a water company, as we said. We can't have a situation where people wouldn't have water. And I can be cynical about politicians, but I do think it would be similar to what we have seen previously with energy companies, where quick solutions happen. I don't think people's taps are going to be running dry as a result of this, but I think there are serious threats to the company itself and restructuring, which is bound not to benefit the consumer. I think they recently asked for a massive hike in water consumer costs of water, which I think were excessive, given that I don't feel there's necessarily the reciprocal amount of investment made to the deficit of shareholders. Mm-hmm. So it's uncertain times for sure. And as I said previously, they're the biggest water company in Europe. So what does that mean? There are other companies that are also in perilous situations. It isn't just Thames, but they're the biggest and the most advanced in their demise, I would say. So actions will be taken, but what the cost will be to smaller groups, which I would suggest consumers probably regarded as, and the river ecosystem is somewhere at the back of that line, I fear for them.
Mm-hmm. And very lastly, the campaign and your organisation have called for action from government, demanded action. It's an election year, whether it's the current government or the next government. If they're listening, what do you want to see? Two or three things that you want to see them do?
Yeah, absolutely. We want to see increase of funding so that regulation can be better. That's the most important, simplest thing. If the water companies and agricultural practices were regulated better, poor practice would be less. And we want to see encouraging investment so that water companies' futures are properly planned, so there's a serious commitment to future investment in new infrastructure. In there's some very simple low-hanging fruits of massive leakage, especially in London, from Victorian sewer system that could be addressed with the right investment so that we don't waste water before we even start policing it.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Now, we've done a lot of episodes on either climate issues or health issues, and now we're doing water, and every time it's like I'm in a bad Simpsons episode, you know, where the regulations and regulators consistently defunded, their powers are taken away from them. What we end up with is private companies, either through malice or incompetence or a bit of both, cause health issues, climate issues that ultimately come back on citizens. So I hope someone is listening to these calls for action. That's Erica Popplewell. Did I pronounce
that
right?
That's right, Popplewell.
Popplewell, Erica Popplewell, head of campaigns at River Action. Erica, thank you so much for joining us. I'll be back with a recap of the show after this.
Thank you.
FUBAR Radio presents.
Amazing. Thank you, Erica. That was brilliant.
So we've got that. The amazing. Yeah, we'll, so we'll... Sunita.
How does Sunita whittle down the people she wants to talk to the people she doesn't? What's your criteria?
Well, you've got to be an adult.
okay.
That's always a good start.
Always a good start. But when I'm an adult, not just like 18, you've got to be like not young enough to be my child. you have to ideally be London-based, because I am. Yeah. Although I don't mind if you've got a country pad, that would be nice.
So at the minute, we're going with age and location are important.
Age and location are good.
Every Friday from 6 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back to Politics Uncensored. You didn't hear anything at the end of that interview, all right? Just erase that from your mind. So last week's show, we spoke about TikTok. And the TikTok ban. And I asked all of you to send in your comments. The question we asked you was, would you be willing to give up TikTok / support a ban on TikTok if your data was being sent to China and the Chinese Communist Party, ruling party in China? And we've had plenty of responses. Thank you to everyone who's commented on various social medias and emailed in and messaged. And what we want to do is read out some of those comments to you and react to what people are saying. It's a really interesting topic because, you know, TikTok has become, I think, one of the predominant social medias. And there's a huge debate predominantly in the US right now in Congress about forcing TikTok to sell its parent company, its US company, to a company that's based in the United States. The concern is that TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, I think, is based out of Beijing, and a lot of the data that's harvested is allegedly could be or is going to the Chinese government. So we asked you, would you be willing to give up TikTok if it was sharing your data? And we've had a load of responses. The first one from Fassi, I'm going to butcher your names, get over it, to be honest. Is your question, and this is now the response from Fassi, is your question, USA is the only player that can collect data? Then no, I don't want my data to be owned, used by any company. So questions around the double standard, which we spoke about on the show last week, specifically around the NSA. Motive 8 says, seeing as how I use a burner phone for social media with a fake email address and a paid VPN, always on, and I put misinformation about myself in my comments. I'm okay with that. Some secret agent there commenting underneath. I think the burner phone is too far motive. I don't think anyone is that interested. Bro, I think you need to relax, is I guess, my concern with you. Lots of comments around the United States. Chaotic TikTok says, my data is sent to the US. Sending it to China is just the same. Like God, but better. Says my data is used by all sorts of companies from every social media going, so why would TikTok be any different? I just don't get why this is even a question. And then a few people who I can't name their usernames because they're so offensive have said things like no, hell no. A couple of people have been talking about Facebook. So the fact that Facebook and Cambridge Analytica scandal has come up as well. And then finally, Sue has said, I don't do anything of interest to anyone. Lol. So clearly she doesn't think she's on the list of data going anywhere because she doesn't think her data is of much use to anyone. Thank you to everybody who's sent a comment in. We want to keep doing that. We're really interested in your views. So this week, I want to ask you about stop and search. With the increase of knife crime, particularly around London, but in major cities all across the UK, I want to ask you whether you support stop and search as a way to tackle knife crime. The data suggests it doesn't work. Lots of research out there suggests that it actually destabilizes relationships between the police and particularly minority communities. Minority, particularly black and brown boys, are disproportionately stopped and searched, which causes huge issues around racism. But many think that it is a key weapon in overturning and overcoming the problem we have with knife crime. So I want to hear from you as to whether you support stop and search and whether police powers should be increased to give them the opportunity and the ability to stop people and search them for weapons, particularly knife crime. You can comment in on all our different social channels on this issue. You can send emails via our website, or just comment down below on my comments on my social media, and we'll read out your responses on the show next week. We've had a packed show today talking about some really, really important issues. Murad Qureshi joined us, former London Assembly member. As people go to the polls, if you're listening, you still have a few hours to get out to the polls as people elect their local councillors, their local mayors and assembly members. We'll talk about the responses to the results on next week's show. I want to thank Murad for talking to us about Sadiq Khan, about the knife crime issue that we've been talking about, as well as the failed Rwanda scheme, as the first failed refugee asylum seeker has gone to Rwanda under a voluntary removals scheme. Mickey Earhart, campaigner at Disability Rights UK, joined us to talk about the plans announced on Monday, which would reform personal independent payments, PIP, including stopping regular cash payments and instead offering claimants a one-off grant. He joined us to talk about Disability Rights UK and his response to that. And Erica Popplewell, head of campaigns at River Action, talked to us about pollution in our waters, Thames Water, and beyond. I want to thank all of them for their contributions to the show and talking about the major issues. It is polling day. It is election day. So get out and vote if you haven't already done so. We're going to be looking at the results coming in over the next few hours and days and discuss them on the show next week. One more time, I just want to thank our guests for joining us, Mickey Earhart, Erica Popplewell, and Murad Qureshi. You can listen into all of our previous shows, and please go and do so. We've had some fantastic guests, both in the studio and virtually, everyone from Jeremy Corbyn to Lord Heseltine, John McDonnell, Dawn Butler. We had the first and only MP for the Green Party, Caroline Lucas, joining us last week. So you can listen to all those previous shows, like and subscribe on all podcasting platforms. That's Apple Podcast, Spotify, and others. You can listen to all those previous shows and listen to our interviews. We like to tackle the big topics on FUBAR, and we're free to talk about anything. We may be the only radio channel that's able to talk about the elections today, for example, as people head to the polls. So do go back and listen to those. You can follow us on all social media platforms. Politics Uncensored UK on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, which is now known as X, and seen increasingly amount of people calling it X these days. So you can follow us and comment on all of the content that we put out. And you can follow me at Ali Milani UK on all these social media platforms. I do still have a TikTok, despite talking about the ban, as long as we are able to. So you can follow me on that, Ali Milani UK, where you can see clips of the show, different discussions, debates, and interviews that we have conducted on the show, on that channel as well. Once again, a big thank you to my guests, a big thank you to you all for listening. Go out and vote. The elections are happening now, and we're going to discuss those issues and their results next week. I've been Ali Milani. This has been Politics Uncensored at FUBAR. I hope to see you all next week. Salams.